deals with building a network for an ephemeral community. Ladies and gentlemen, Johnny Diggs, Willow Brew.
So the thing behind us is going to be a little bit clipped, and so I hope you don't judge me on my design skills. I promise I centered everything perfectly. It's technical issues.
It looks really perfect right here.
It does. It's amazing. So we're going to talk to you today about Geeks Without Bounds, which acts as an accelerator for humanitarian projects. We do 1 to 5 hackathons internationally every month, which we usually see as sort of speed dating between people with technical skills or design skills and organizations that could really use their help, either in humanitarian or disaster response. We also support some of those projects and teams through six months of mentorship in things like human rights and information security and business development, so that they are responsible not only to themselves but also to the people that they're hoping to help. And the specific thing that we're going to focus on today is what it is to build an open source cell network at Burning Man.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we focus on in addition to crisis response and humanitarian response is communications, because when I founded Geeks Without Bounds with Willow, one of the big things that I was focused on, basically based on my background, is helping people communicate in times of crisis, and that's one of the key things that anytime there's a disaster response team, one of the top priorities is to get comms up right away.
And right now, most of the time when comms are put up by the formal sector, it is for the official responders. They don't consider the first responders to be the people that already live there. And so one of the things that we really like doing is helping to also put up satellite uplinks in disaster zones. That way, the people who live in an area can self-organize because they have better access to communications. So, Diggs, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes.
If it'll work. You know, maybe.
So I'm Johnny Diggs. That's actually my stage name. I'm a professional dueling piano player. So I was encouraged to take a stage name. So Johnny Diggs seemed to work well. I'm also a co-founder of several technology companies. IRDG, which we founded in 95, which was focused on unified messaging. Voxeo, which is a internet interactive voice response company. And most recently, Tropo, which I'm the chief evangelist. I do all of our developer outreach. Tropo is a over-the-top voice application development platform. And also Geeks Without Bounds with Willow, and I just recently got involved with starting Orlando's first makerspace.
And I am Willow Rue. You'll notice that both of these pictures are from Burning Man, which, of course, that makes sense. I do things with Geeks Without Bounds. I'm also at Center for Civic Media, with the MIT Media Lab, with the Berkman Center for Internet Society. They let me hang out and visit their libraries. It's amazing. I also am working with the Roddenberry Disaster Response Team, where we bring in water filtration systems to disaster zones and help set it up. It pumps through 500 gallons of clean water a day out of any non-salinated water source, and then we leave that stuff behind so that they can set up markets around clean water. And also the Space Federation, which linked together a bunch of hacker and maker spaces, specifically in America. So Black Rock City, where Burning Man happens.
It's basically in the middle of nowhere. Has anybody been to Burning Man before? So, you know, maybe 5%. Your closest airport, or closest large airport, is Reno, about a 2-hour drive north of Reno, directly into the middle of the desert.
And then, oh, hey, what's up? Sidebar. Don't get annoying. And then about 75,000, or not, mm-hmm. And then about 70,000 people show up to a place that nothing else is happening, and they set up camp for about a week, and they hang out, and then they all leave with all of their stuff again. We also set things on fire.
Burn, burn.
And we also build lots of weird art.
So, yeah, one of the things that, one of the most common misconceptions about Burning Man is that it's a music festival, but it there is music there. It's usually a lot of wub, 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 but dubstep. But there's also live music, but it's not specifically a music event. It's culture. It's about sharing things. It's a dirt rave. but it's also about radical self-reliance. It's about, they have these 10 principles, guiding principles of Burning Man, which include everything from that there's not really any exchange of money there. It's more of a gifting economy. You can buy ice and coffee, and that's just about it. But it's also about radical self-reliance, leaving no trace behind, fully participate, you know, being participatory, and also immediacy, which is also very important.
And it's also an experimental wonderland. And in disaster response, it's really difficult to try out new things because usually you have to do whatever you can with what you have right then. And there's no space to really try something because if it goes wrong, things are really bad. But if you suddenly have this influx of a population, it's like a test bed, but nobody cares if you mess up, which is exciting. And this is basically the population of the what we call the playa. It's a joking term about the beach, because the ground is actually usually a lake that it's a lake during the winter, and then it all evaporates, and it does that over and over and over, and it ends up with this really alkaline, really fine soil that eats everything. And it gets on all of your plates, and if you're even slightly compulsive, it is the worst thing ever.
eats all of your electronics.
Yes, and so the population of the playa tends to be zero. There are a few festivals that happen over the summer, and then there's this huge peak that happens right around Labor Day, which is when Burning Man is. And that means that... Will you work? The nearby town of Gerlach has a population of 250 people in it.
That's the closest semblance of a town. And Gerlach has a cell phone tower, one lonely cell phone tower, that is designed to support Gerlach. But in more recent years, they've pointed that thing towards the playa to support Burning Man. But the problem is that it is one lonely cell phone tower. And when you have a peak of suddenly 70,000 people... you'll notice a decline in service very quickly.
And so we want to know what we can learn from this gap in infrastructure. How can we play with this?
So this is the Burning Man layout is sort of a half circle. This is sort of a heat map of where we put towers a couple years ago. I don't know how well that's showing up there, but those circles are centered around cell phone towers. So we try, obviously, to get 100% coverage over Burning Man. This year we got about 70% coverage. And obviously, the more towers you put up, the more coverage you can have. Before we get into sort of the details, this has been floating around for a long time. I did not create this, but... If you care to understand how your fucking phone works, I suggest looking this Prezi up later on and zooming into some of these because it's really, really funny. I'm not going to go into all the details, but basically your phone connects to a local BTS station, just like the one that they were showing on stage before, and that is connected to a network, and the magic of... The phone network finds you, and your phone rings, and it's magic. And that's how you get a fucking phone call.
This is what our network looked like.
I'm not going to go too much into the details. There's a link here if you want to get into the really technical details of how, you know, specifically what the connections were like in the network. But we used almost 100% open source software with a couple exceptions. OpenBTS, which is an open source based transceiver station software written by David Burgess and Harvin And then Asterisk we use for database, for phone registrations. Yates stands for yet another telephony engine. And then, of course, Tropo, which we use to build some simple applications, because without an application platform like Tropo, you wouldn't really be able to do much other than send and receive phone calls. And also Tropo provided a link to let people make outbound phone calls into what they call the default world, which is the world we're living in right now.
These are what those towers actually look
pretty
like.
Pretty pictures of towers. These were all actually set up. We used a variety of different towers. Some of them were portable towers, like the one that is right there. That is actually designed to be set up by one person. Believe me, it can't be set up by one person. We used trucks, like news vans, to set up some of them, so we can get enough coverage all around in various places. And obviously the higher and more spread out your towers are, the more coverage you're going to be able to have. So here's some data from 2012. I tried to get our 2013 data, but the guy who has it all is in Bucharest right now and didn't respond to me in a timely fashion.
By which we mean this morning when we were making sure everything worked okay.
Love you, David.
So 2012, we had 5 sites in a variety of different configurations. The end result was we had about 1,100 phones subscribed to the network, and about 8,000 phone calls made to the outside world over the course of the week. With handset requirements, we required that you had an unlocked quadband GSM phone, which is fairly common outside the U.S. We specifically blocked AT&T SIMs for no other reason than that lonely tower over at Gerlach was an AT&T service provider, so we didn't want them. We were running a legal network. We had a license, but we didn't want any insinuation that we were interfering with the commercial network, so we block AT&T phones. And then we also provide SIM cards at our camp, so if you wanted to try it out, you could come and we just gave out free SIM cards. We actually had some free burner phones. These were like...
That was a pun.
was actually accurate because they're really cheap feature phones that you can get for like $10 that we would pre-configure, and if you didn't want to mess with anything else, we just handed it to you. Asked if you would please bring it back at the end of the week, but we only got a few of those back. A lot of people like to keep them as souvenirs. So inside the network, you could make phone calls to other people who are registered on the network. So when I call that playa-to-playa, voice calls, you could do playa-to-playa SMS. We very much limited the ability to make calls inbound. And the way we did that was when your phone registered into the network, when you roamed in, you got a unique 6-digit phone number. So it didn't... interfere with your normal 10-digit phone number. But when you tried to make a phone call out of the network, we did that through Tropo, which went over VoIP, and the receiving caller would see a normal 10-digit caller ID, but it looked like a phone call from coming from Reno. And then if that person answered, you could talk to them. If they didn't answer, they could call back to that number, and for a limited period of time, like 30 minutes, we actually would route that phone call back based on the caller ID back to your 6-digit phone number on the playa. So if you needed to get an answer from someone, they could call you back. But it also prevented your boss from bothering you or anybody else trying to sell you something while you're trying to enjoy Burning Man. So that's kind of how we limited. We said, you know, after 30 minutes, that connection is burned. You'll see a theme here. And so we also did some other apps via Tropo. which included group messaging, sort of like GroupMe or WhatsApp type stuff. We created an app for voice messaging. So if you wanted to leave a message from other people in your camp, they could you could leave a message and say, hey, everybody meet at the giant steampunk octopus at 8 o'clock. And then other people would call in and listen to the messages, and just like a voice message board. We also provided text messaging alerts for Exodus. So one of the big challenges anybody who's ever been to Burning Man knows is getting in and getting out. So you've got one road. You got to go through Gerlach and wind your way in, and then there's a gate where everybody has to go through little security checkpoints. And so you got 70,000 people that are entering in within a short 24, 48-hour window. There's 70,000 people also leave within a short window. So last year we actually set up an app for what they call Exodus. So you could subscribe to it and get a text message, send a text message and find out what the wait time at the gate was. And so if the wait time was 6 hours, you might as well hang out at your camp for a little while before you get in your car, unless you like sitting in your car for 6 hours. And also weather alerts. Last year was one of the first times in a long time they had a severe weather come through right at the end of Burning Man. And so we were able to send a text message out to let people know that a big storm was coming. And they don't let you drive on the playa at all if it's raining, because it eats up the... It eats up the desert, and one of those tenets was leave no trace, so eating up the desert would actually be a trace, I guess.
And this is really interesting. I hope most of you were here for the previous talk, because it was amazing, and the question of how the community decides what the social bounds to be reinforced by the technology are. So can your cell phone call only last for an hour, ensuring that you still go and visit people? A lot of debate happens over whether or not to get on these networks and what appropriate use of them is. And so one of the things that we play around with is not just the technical aspect of what does it look like to set up this infrastructure, but also what is appropriate use. So that was one of the things that bounded whether the time limit on someone being able to call you back and what sorts of things people use the SMS for. They decided on their own the latter part, but it was interesting to see.
It is. It's been. I would not say that this network, which has been the last 6 or 7 years, been part of our camp project. It's not without its controversy. Some people don't think that cell phones have a place on the playa. We actually feel that everybody is responsible for their own equipment, and they can choose to turn their cell phone off or not bring it with them. But we find that a lot of people do actually like to have the ability to communicate. So some of the lessons learned, specifically that opt-in policy I was just talking about, that we don't actually force your phone to connect to our network. You really do have to try. You have to set it up to do that. So if you really want to, you can. But most people don't. And a lot of people, you know, we've had some people that are really, really adamant and like one guy come screaming at us saying that we were ruining his Burning Man experience. We just kind of sit there and go, how? Like, because there's, I mean, anyway. So, like I said, it's not without its controversy. Over the course of the last few years, we've learned about the registration process. So if you've ever roamed into a foreign country, you always get a text message that says, you know, welcome to the Netherlands. You know, voice calls are $17 a minute. And text messages are $5 each. Whereas our message is, you know, welcome to Burning Man Network. Voice calls are free, and SMS messages are free. And if you would like to join, just respond with yes, and we'll send you your unique 6-digit phone number. And so creating that, it took us a while to figure out. We tried with IVR systems where people had to call in, or they had to come to our camp. And we realized that the best way is to do it the way that people are used to seeing it when they roam into a new network. One of the the big lessons we learned a few years ago was one of our engineers was playing around with the network and without really consulting or talking to the rest of us, sent out a text message to everyone on every cell phone that was turned on, that included the AT&T ones, that said, "Welcome to Burning Man. We're your cellular provider. We're located here. If you want to come by and learn about our camp, come visit us." And so the so I likened it to a zombie apocalypse because when the rest of us woke up in the morning, there were literally, you know, dozens of people standing there with looking up at the tower at our camp with their cell phone, and they look at the tower, and they look at their cell phone, and then, like, I would walk up to them, like, "Hey, friend, how you doing? Can I help you?" And they were like, "I got this message on my phone, and I don't, did you hack into my phone?" And so, inevitably, I'd be like, "Well, no, I explained a little bit of what we were doing." And they were like, "Well, it doesn't seem to be working." And I'm like, "Well, do you want it to work? Or do you just need to make a phone call?" And 9 times out of 10, they would be like, they'd sit there and think about it. "I kind of just wanted to make a phone call." And so I would point over to this little handset
that is covered in dust, like everything.
Yeah, and I'd be like, "You can just use that phone. Just, you know, just dial whatever number you want to call on." And they would be like, "Oh, cool." And the next thing they would do is they'd go over and pick up the phone, and they'd put it up to their ear, and they'd hear dial tone, and you'd be like, "Dial tone." Like. And then they would go to dial a number, and then have to pick up their cell phone again. And look up the number that they needed to dial. But yeah, many of the times, people just needed to make a phone call. And for the perfect example, a couple years ago, we had a young guy came to our camp, and he was like, "I hear you guys have cell phone service." And he's like, "I really need to make a phone call." And I did my spiel, you know, do you need your cell phone to work? Do you just need to make a phone call? And he's like, "I just need to make a phone call." And so, you know, he gets on the phone, and it's very interesting because, you know, this is set up inside one of our tents, and the rest of us are, like, eating breakfast. So we hear a lot of really difficult conversations because these are people that are at Burning Man, but usually they're making a phone call because they really need to make a phone call. And sometimes it's just people who are just checking on their parents or their kids or their pets or whatever. But this guy, right as he was coming in, got a text message from his mom. He was riding with some other people saying that his brother was in the hospital. And so he wanted to call his mom to find out, "Hey, do I need to, like, come home right now? Like, what is this, you know?" And it turns out his brother just had broken his arm in a motorcycle accident and was fine. So the guy was, like, really relieved that he didn't, you know, first of all, his brother wasn't that hurt, obviously. Was not relieved that his brother broke his arm, but he didn't need to actually, it wasn't that big of an emergency. And so a lot of people came to us with logistical problems like that. And that kind of leads to what we were talking earlier about, the humanitarian aspect of why we kind of spend our time setting up this network in the middle of the desert, because a lot of times we learn things about people's relationship with their phone and communication, but we get to do that in a generally safe environment that isn't an emergency.
And so one of the things about... Wow, I totally just skipped over something. That's okay. So when people attend Burning Man, some of them take an entire year to plan, and some of them take a few days to plan and just kind of show up. But people, regardless of that much planning and what they're used to, they still really like the idea of being able to communicate with other people. And so we're going to break from this for just a little bit, and I'm going to tell you about some of the other projects that Geeks Without Bounds does, which are all in an attempt to see what mutual aid at a global scale looks like. What can I, as a fairly pasty person, do to show up somewhere and say, "I have certain skills, are they actually useful to the group here? And also, what can I learn? And what do we need to learn? The previous talk, again, was incredible, and I love the things that we can learn from those communities and those rural networks. It's incredible. So I spent some time in Tanzania recently, which is in East Africa, specifically in Mafinga, which is out in southwestern rural Tanzania. And we were working on water infrastructure. So a whole lot of money has been put into water points, which are basically, if you don't have enough water infrastructure, there are these giant things are called gravity points, where there's a very thin pipe that sometimes trickles water into these things, and then someone sits at the tap and they dole out water and they charge people for the water. And a whole lot of these have been installed, and a whole lot of them break, and no one knows where they are and which ones are working, and so people just keep dumping more money into installing more.
What's the statistic of...
I think it's... the Tanzanian government says that 60% of Tanzanians have clean drinking water, and that is so not true. and so what we did was we worked with community partners, specifically SNV, for people who had feature phones, because there is good connectivity there, to report when something was broken or fixed, which also assumes that there is, gives a general idea of where it is. I, from coming to hacker cons and spending time in hacker groups for a long time, insisted that we not be able to link those reports back to the specific user, because if this ends up being used for other reporting of infrastructure, might not be good if the individual is linked to that report. So if someone reports something is broken, or if using an open source water sensor, like out of public labs, reports that there's no flow of water, then a water engineer would get an update, or anyone with a wrench would get an update saying, hey, this point is broken, you should go fix it. They go fix it. And then we end up with reports of what's going on, so that people, if the government is not fulfilling their obligation of fixing these water points, which they have money to fix, if they're not doing it, you at least have the documentation that something is going wrong. And also you can see how the water engineers are doing. Are they fulfilling their duty? And we can start to see who is responsible for which points, when it was last broken, when it was fixed, etc. So that's one project. Another project is the Bachao project out of Bangalore, India, which is just a distress application. It uses your cell phone, a hot button starts, it updates a list of people that you have pre-described about your last known location, and it also starts auto-uploading via any means available to the phone, to a server. And it holds up in court. It's court admissible, and so it's used for incidents mostly of gender-based violence. And there's also something like Mozilla emergency badges, which are, we have this really weird PTSD that's starting to happen around digital response, where people hear, and also in activism, digital activism, of people getting all of these like notifications of how wrong everything is, and oh my god, this thing is flooded, or this thing is on fire, and we don't have food, and we're trapped over here. And you do everything within your power to help them based on where you are, and then you don't hear anything back. And it's really, really damaging to the psyche. And so the idea of this is that while there are many people affected in disaster, and there are many organizations out there that are there to help them, and there are lots of volunteers that are there to help them, what is planned for is often not what people end up doing, and so we have a strong emphasis at Gwaborg, I like to say, of just embracing the messiness, of assuming that people are totally competent at self-organizing so long as you get out of their way. So we just connect people directly so that they can say that someone actually helped them via SMS, and the person gets the notification that they helped them, and it also sets up credentialing that is external to organizations so that they can take that with them wherever they go. They can just show up in an area and say, I am certified in the following four things in this standardly accepted format. And then there's... How are we on time? Oh, man. We're pretty good. Sweet. Okay. yes. Okay, and then there's... I didn't draw this one yet because it's still emerging, funnily enough. Emergent Infrastructure Challenge. So In the same way that there's this sudden influx of people for Burning Man, we see a similar trend only in population influx, not in basically any other way, for refugee camps. And so a large number of people have to leave their home suddenly, and you have to set up infrastructure for a large influx of people where there hasn't been infrastructure before. And so there are three groups that are really interested in figuring out how to help this out, and I want to figure out how to combine them. So one is Doctors Without Borders has a really great how to set up the sanitation infrastructure in a way that is aware of gender-based violence. So usually people just set up restrooms and then even more awful things continue to happen in an already dire situation. And so they just have a basic, like, here is how you ask questions. You have to have a female translator. Here are the sorts of questions you can ask. Here's how you adhere to it. It's very much based on community design and co-design. And then here's how you deploy that. So that's one section. It's in a PDF format. They just need to be able to transfer it between phones. Like, this is Doctors Without Borders, and they don't have access to good technology. They're pretty good at telemedicine, but not much else. Good people. And then there's also UNHCR realizes that in these camps, they are the bottleneck for information. People will stand outside the offices for most of a day in order to ask a simple question. And they have realized that they're the bottleneck. Like, well, everybody has feature phones and maybe even smartphones, and there's definitely a network in most of these places. So can we just build a collective intelligence platform? Like, is that a wiki? How do we do that? And so they're eager to do this, and with material like what Doctors Without Borders has, we can start to seed these platforms. And then also have, because so much of this is geographically based, and then you have to meet sphere standards, which is the minimum requirements to treat people like people in these situations, then you can have the updating mechanism through Tarifa. So, cool projects. We like them. And all of them are accepting help. And we would love your help with them.
Mostly with open source, you know, GitHub stuff. There you can go and see what they need and all that stuff. So it's, if you have some free time and you have the skills, all these projects could use some help.
Yeah. So, again, workshop on Saturday with the crew that was just up. Really encourage you to go to that. Leisha, who's also from Geeks Without Bounds and is amazing, and I hope she's in the audience somewhere, she's going to give a talk on Sunday morning about cybersecurity and humanitarian projects. I know that I love being awake at 10 a.m. on Sunday. actually, I do. I usually wake up really awfully early, but I hope that you will join me here with enthusiasm.
And the last thing, in November 21st through 23rd in Portland, we're going to be doing we're trying something new. We're doing a conference that's combining telephone application developers and hackers with humanitarian response professionals and digital humanitarians, and also art. So should be an interesting conference that we're working on. So if you want to learn more about that, I suggest you follow the Geeks Without Bounds Twitter account, because we don't have a whole lot posted yet.
So that's what we've got. And we have so much time for questions, because I'm not used to doing broadcast mode. I like interaction.
So, questions? Thank you. Yeah, so the question was to elaborate on our licensing procedure. We operated, the FCC has a thing called an experimental license, puts you in a specific frequency zone and power wattage, and as long as you stay within their parameters, and you have to obviously clearly define what you do and where you're doing it. So part of the reason we're able to get that, and consistently able to get that, is because of the remote area that we're working in. And also, these are all professionals that everyone in our camp, in the Papa Legba camp, are professionals that work specifically in this area. So we like to follow the rules.
Hi, I have two questions. I think they're related. So one is for SMS, can people SMS to the outside world? And if so, is it with their own number? And then two is, how do people discover other people's numbers within the camp? And kind of how do they, because if I say want to call my friend who I know is on the other side, how do I know what his number is?
Good questions. We did not enable SMS to the outside world. We felt that it wasn't a technical limitation. It was sort of a community limitation. We didn't want people to be sitting there texting their friends all the time. It sort of went against our attempts to limit the ability for people to call back, because if you have a long-running text conversation within 30 minutes, it would just keep that connection alive. And we really didn't want to encourage that much connectivity. But like I said, that was not a technical limitation. We did not have any sort of directory services. Typically, you share that by voice. You did have the ability to call into the message board and leave your numbers, and so if somebody else wanted to call in. And then, once you had other people's numbers, you could create, group texting. So if you wanted to text out to 15 people in your camp, you could do that.
So can you just describe how the message board works a little bit?
Say that again.
Can you describe how the message board works a little bit?
The voice message board?
Yeah.
Basically, it was a message board per camp. So you're the first person to join from your camp would set up the message board. There would be a unique message board ID. It was like an IVR system. You call in, please enter your camp ID. It's a six-digit number. And then it would just play like voicemail.
And there's also Center Camp, which is the center of Burning Man. And they have an opt-in registry where you can say where your camp is and that you specifically as a person are with that camp. And so some people were leaving their phone numbers in their details with full knowledge that anyone looking them up would be able to see that phone number.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I jokingly refer to it as an opt-in-a-con. Opt-in-a-con?
Opt-in-a-con.
Do you think your infrastructure could be used to build distributed sensor networks, specifically gunshot detection?
You're speaking about Tarifa network. The Waterpoint is sort of a distributed sensor network. Is it? Is that what you're just?
Specifically, if you could use cell phones to. To spread out over large territory and then be able to monitor gun violence and to be able to locate...
As far as reporting, Tarifa is just a triaging platform. You can report anything. They've also used it for education. If teachers have showed up today or the state of the school or whatever else. And so people could report that they had heard something and then you could do some triage around that. Triangulation around it, but it's not running the mic at all times, and so it's not the same thing as what they've had in Oakland.
Do you think of developing an open source phone or using another firmware for an existing phone, for an existing cheap phone, to be able to use it as a reporting node continuously without human involvement?
You could. We don't have any projects on that right now, though.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Hi, great talk. Thank you. I had a question about data on the network. Were there any thoughts about maybe the same way you didn't let text messages out of the network, but creating maybe data that's local just to the Burning Man, like some apps or anything?
So we didn't provide any data channel to date. The Burning Man infrastructure, they have an infrastructure team, provides pretty good Wi-Fi coverage. And so it didn't, so if you wanted to get Wi-Fi, you can. You have to be associated with a camp that has applied for it and jumped through all the hoops to make sure you get it. But so for that reason, plus some technical limitations and, you know, and just time and effort, we didn't supply any data. And so, you know, we may sometime in the future to do some basic data, but yeah, we've focused mostly on voice and SMS.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
With your experimental license with the FCC, do they, you know, as a, quote, regular cell phone network, they have to do all kinds of compliance stuff with 911 and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Are you just completely exempt from that
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, experimental networks are exempt from emergency E911 and regular 911. And we make that very clear that that if there is an emergency, you know, find a Burning Man ranger or go to, you know, there's plenty of police presence on the playa. So, and they're actually usually very, very good. They're there to make sure that nobody gets hurt. But yeah, we made it abundantly clear that we are not providing commercial service. This is experimental, and for educational purposes.
So, what happened if you dialed 911? You had like an interrupt that just said, hey, go find somebody. This isn't going to work.
Yeah, exactly. You got like an automated response.
Hi. How do you handle backhaul between the sites?
I don't really want to go too much into the detail of that, but all of that is explained. If you go to that link that's in this, we'll post the link to this shortly, but. To the presentation, but essentially it was point to point connectivity between the different towers.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hi. I have a question about one of the other projects that you mentioned briefly, Ba Chao, and I was wondering if you could talk about how that works and maybe if you know about Kite String, how it compares to that service.
So. Ba Chao is headed up by an amazing woman named Shinmai, who lives in Bangalore, and I don't know any of the technical details about how her project works. I only know how to help get it in front of the news and whatever else. But yes. Yes, will you come stand at the microphone? Leisha is in the audience. This is amazing. I just draw stick figures. I use crayons mostly. I don't know how these things work.
Okay, so the original Ba Chao project was created at Random Acts of Kindness, a year and a half ago? The original Ba Chao was created at Random Acts of Kindness about a year and a half ago. It was an Android app it still exists. The original Android app still exists. And it is... That version is just an Android app with a panic button, like Willow explained, and it just uses, you know, the Android infrastructure basically to send text messages to up to 5 people that you preload and call the police, the local police number, 911 or 111 or whatever your local one is, and upload audio and video according to whatever its connectivity infrastructure at that space at that moment is for use in courts, like you were saying. Ba Chao has continued to expand what they're doing, though. So now they're doing specific use tools like pendants that look like pendants, that are panic buttons that basically have all that functionality that was on the panic button on your phone can now be had independent. So the other program, I don't actually know, what's it called? Something
Kite String, I think.
I don't know the functionality of that. I know that there are several other panic button tools out there. When we were doing the mentorship, so... I think Ba Chao graduated from our accelerator program 6 months ago, 8 months ago. And At that time, none of the other panic button applications that were available had the streaming piece of it, which was actually, you know, one of the key pieces. It wasn't just that you were asking for help. It was that you actually had evidence, you know, in case this went to court, so that it didn't turn around where they started persecuting and prosecuting the victim. You had proof.
Yeah, one of the cool things was when you hit that panic button, it turns on your microphone and your camera and immediately starts streaming audio and video to the cloud. So even if someone took your phone, the evidence would already be up in the cloud.
So I don't know where you went, but did that answer your question?
Yes, that was great.
Okay. I think we're good. Thank you all so much for your attention. Okay.
Okay. One quick thing about Burning Man, of course, the big motto there is, of course, piss clear here. 521 is the best thing I can suggest so you have a good conference. For those of you who don't know what that is, those are the bare minimums we suggest. Every night, get 5 hours of sleep. Make sure you have 2 square meals a day and 1 shower.
A day.